From the Sky News Centre at 5, Tunisia's health ministry says British tourists are among the victims of a terror attack in a country that's left 28 people dead. 36 others have been wounded. Tourists have been describing the moment they heard the shots, ran for cover and hid in their rooms. Gary Pine was on the beach when it started.
Over to our left, about 100 yards or so away, we thought what was firecrackers going off. You could see quite quickly the panic that was starting to ensue, but only when you could start hearing bullets whizzing around your ears did you realise that it was something a lot more serious than firecrackers.
One gunman was killed. Sean Tipton from the travel association ABTA has this advice for anyone due to fly to Tunisia.
If you are due to fly out in the next day or two with one of our members, we'd recommend pretty strongly that you contact the tour operator concerned just to see what your options are. If you're travelling independently, you need to discuss that with your airline.
French authorities have arrested a man after a car was driven into a factory and a decapitated body was found nearby in Lyon. Flags with Arabic writing were also discovered at the scene. Elsewhere, Islamic State's claimed responsibility for a mosque attack in Kuwait that's left 25 people dead. In other news this afternoon, a former doorman's been jailed for a minimum of 35 years for murdering his parents. He drugged his father and mother before killing them and staging a break-in at their home in Newcastle to cover his tracks. The US Supreme Court's ruled in favour of gay marriage in a historic decision that legalises it in all 50 states. It means states can't ban same-sex marriages. US President Barack Obama's described the decision as a victory for America.
Sometimes there are days like this when that slow, steady effort is rewarded with justice that arrives like a thunderbolt.
BCFM. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Labour councillor for Bedminster and now also candidate for mayor, Mark Bradshaw. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, as the banksters haul Greece over the coals once more this weekend, seeing how much Greek politicians will let British and German banks buy up before the pips squeak, we ask who's really in charge? Banks, media barons and corporations seem to have gotten together with Europe's royal families and American dynasties such as the Clintons, the Bushes and the Rockefellers to create a modern industrial feudal system where they don't care who you vote for because they own all the major political parties. There's no elections for the tycoons that run it all. So if David Cameron's the Sheriff of Nottingham, where are the Robin Hoods of our age? Also, some say Bristol's Avon and Somerset police officers are as angry as many of the rest of us at austerity, with 600 less police officers since the 2010 election. But if they want our support, why, like what happened in Iceland, aren't they arresting and charging the banksters who've run off with the loot? Or come to that, the VI paedophiles, who only seem to be being arrested and charged after they've popped their clogs. Kevin Phillips is here from Avon and Somerset Police Federation to explain why some criminals are just too big to jail. How exactly does that one work? Plus, it's Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, light showers, lows of 14 degrees Celsius, but mainly dry. And next, sunny on Saturday this week, but cloudy with some rain on Sunday. Next week, highs of 31, would you believe? 31 Celsius, heating up dramatically next week, and midweek being the hottest, possibly thunderous, heavy downpours on Thursday. Next weekend, that's the 4th and 5th of July, highs of 23, sunshine and showers. And also, of course, if you've noticed, you may, if there is a clear sky tonight, be able to see the Northern Lights, even from Bristol tonight, we hear. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Labour councillor for Bedminster, candidate for Mayor, Mark Bradshaw. Hi, Mark. Welcome to The Politics Show.
Hello, Tony.
So how did you manage to get a nomination to stand for Mayor? It's actually quite a long time until this is going to be a long, long election campaign, isn't it?
Well, I'm on the shortlist, so I haven't been actually elected yet as our candidate, so I'm standing against Marvin Rees to be the Labour candidate.
But why would Labour want to put forward someone that lost last time? I mean, that just does a no-brainer, surely.
Well, we're competing at the moment, and whoever wins that will be our candidate next year.
I mean,
and I think it's important that there's a really strong candidate against George Ferguson and indeed other party candidates next year.
But I mean, people would be rather blinking, rubbing their eyes, wouldn't they, if they thought Ed Miliband was going to lead the Labour Party into the next general election after having lost the last one?
Well, obviously, I'll leave Marvin to talk for himself. My campaign is focused around the big priorities for the city, such as getting more homes built. So I'll stand on my record and what I'd like to do, and I'm sure Marvin will stand on his.
Well, it's nice to hear you talking about getting homes built, but we've been hearing about that for the last 5 years. Lots of people who won our votes say we're going to build homes, and they never do.
Well, we've had a mayor here for the last 3.5 years who really hasn't built very much at all, and certainly hasn't built many new homes, and that's what I'd like to do if
I'd
become mayor.
Well, he'd argue that he can't. He's not allowed to. Right for councils simply to do that sort of thing was pretty much stopped in the Thatcher era.
But did you know, Tony, that within Bristol there's probably 80 brownfield sites that if they were built could provide about 7,000 new homes?
Yeah, are they owned by the council though?
Quite a few of them are.
Well, how many roughly? Because, I mean, you can't force someone to sell for a price if a developer says it's just not worth it.
Well, part of the deal when we got an elected mayor is that that mayor would fight for new powers, would fight for a city deal which enabled us to build those homes. That hasn't happened. So you need a new mayor, I would argue, to get a new deal for the city to actually get those homes built. You know, we've got a housing waiting list of nearly 15,000 people. It's really unforgivable.
Well, asking for a Bristol mayor to get a new deal from Westminster is a bit like David Cameron asking to get a new deal from the EU, isn't it? I mean, it's just not. I mean, for example, this week he's been sitting in Berlin with the Queen and Angela Merkel, and they've just basically told him, no, forget it.
But you look at the deals being done for Manchester and Sheffield and Leeds and Cardiff, and we're being left out of that. And all the early promise that, you know, George would get this great deal for Bristol has just evaporated. So I believe you need a new mayor focusing on these really big issues, such as getting homes built and actually also supporting people in the private rented sector who, you know, face a very insecure future in terms of rising rents and potential eviction.
So if you become mayor, how will you actually get those houses built?
We have sites. I know where those sites are. We have a housing zone, for example, in the south of the city, that there are 7 sites there that could provide about 1,200 new homes.
Now, is that all brownfield, or are we talking
that's
about...
That's all brownfield, that's all in the planning
system.
Because you
remember
what
happened to Gary Hopkins when he started suggesting we should be building on corners of parks and things?
All brownfield sites.
You know, so how are you going to pay for them?
How are we going to pay for them? We would work with the housing associations and private investors, and obviously build some council homes as well. It requires a deal around right to buy. It requires a deal about investment, particularly infrastructure. But we can get the powers, and working with other agencies, make this happen. You need a mayor who is interested in this sort of stuff and will get it done.
Okay, right to buy, how? The council's right to buy the land, or the housing association's right to buy it? Who's right to buy what?
Well, at the moment, we build a council house and we're struggling to build, I think, 71 over the next 3 years. Quite a few of those will go to right to buy, which in some cases go into the buy-to-let market and therefore fueling the rent increases. And the government's currently proposing to extend right to buy to housing association homes as well. We think that's a bad idea. Most people think that's a bad idea. I'd like to get an exemption for Bristol on the basis that if we commit to build more social homes, we could be exempt from right to buy for, say, 10 or so years. We need to build up the stock. If we're to do anything for the 14,000, nearly 15,000 people who are waiting for a home, we've got to get more social homes built.
But I mean, that's a crossing your fingers, Mark, isn't it? It's not realistic to expect an exemption from the central government. It's a Tory government. They've decided they want to do this.
But they also want homes built, and we could commit to building those homes.
The thing is, they're thinking
and
that
unlock that.
When people buy their own homes, they're more likely to vote Tory, so they will want people to buy their own homes.
But I'm afraid, you know, we've got 15,000 people on the waiting list and a widening affordability gap, which means that for many people and a growing number of people, the prospect of owning your own home, saving up for a deposit, is just not realistic, is not going to happen.
Okay, so let's have a commitment from you. How many homes are you going to actually build? A promise.
The mayor promised 1,000 a year. I think I can match that. I think I can exceed that.
But he's got
nothing
like
that. But I would need
that.
Those new powers.
He's got nothing like that.
Well, I think this year they're going to build 300 affordable homes. That's nowhere near what we need. With new powers and new funding and these brownfield sites, I think I could do a lot better than that. And I know I could do a lot better than that.
Okay. Also, what about other candidates? Who else has thrown their hat into the ring other than you and Mervyn for the Labour candidate for mayor?
Well, Mayor Ferguson launched his crowdfunder, which was basically saying, I'm a very rich man, please give me your money as well. But apart from that, I've not seen any other candidates appear yet.
Okay, and do you think it's going to be a long campaign? I mean, we're nearly actually a year to go still for the election. So it sounds a bit, you know, like a very, very long campaign this is looking at.
I think in my experience, it will go very, very quickly. But it gives us all time to set out exactly what we would do and to be challenged on that. So it is a long road. But of course, you've got all-out council elections as well. So it will really set the scene in Bristol for the next 4 years. It's a really important election, both in terms of the mayoral and the local council elections as well. It could be a turning point for the city. It is that important.
Okay. What would you point to as one of the main bugbears with George Ferguson then in this campaign?
Well, he doesn't listen. He doesn't listen. He's not focusing on the issues that really matter. So he's focusing on an arena, and we all want an arena, and we've all worked hard over the years to actually achieve that. But very few homes are being built. There's very little being done for people in the private rented sector. But public transport is still nowhere near where it ought to be. So we need a better deal in terms of bus powers. We need more investment. We need more investment in rail as well. I would like to electrify all the local rail stations, to tracks, to build new stations as well. This is going to require a commitment from a central government, working with our partners. Those are the issues that really matter. And also just basic council services, like getting the bins emptied on the street. You know, you just walk up the Stapleton Road and Old Market and Eastern. I was in St Mark's Road last week. The bins are overflowing. These are basic council services that need to be provided.
And you've been involved.
You expect the council to do that.
As part of the transport portfolio,
yeah.
With the Metro bus.
Yeah.
Why was it that when all the pinch points happened, really, which is effectively when there was evictions and all the trouble at Stapleton allotments, you were over in China?
I wasn't in China.
Well, where were you?
I was here. I was in Bristol.
Okay.
I think the mayor may have been in China. I was here in Bristol.
Okay. So, why did that happen? I mean, there was an incredible. What was the bill for the eviction of those protesters?
I think, in terms of the west of England, it was over £1 million in terms of the security and evictions.
So, surely we could have spent that £1 million on just diverting the route just slightly, maybe buying a corner of another field or something?
Well, this is the bus only junction. So, there was strong advice from Highways England, who manage the M32, that we couldn't put any further vehicles, particularly Metro bus, on Junction 1 of the M32.
Are you worried that the Metro bus protest might come back to haunt you in your campaign? Because there's a lot of people turned out, gave up their weekends to try and save those allotments that your project has now mashed.
Well, it's a West of England project, and it's one that the mayor also signed up to.
Well, you backed it, Mark, didn't you?
Because it brings in £200 to £300 million of investment for public transport that we're crying out for.
Is this bus going to work, this Metro bus, this guided bus? I've seen an article saying misguided bus, and in France they've just given it up. They've been trying for 10 years to make it work. They've had enough.
Well, it's out of my hands now. It's for someone else to lead on, but I believe that having more public transport capacity and having better services and easier ways to actually pay, linking that public transport up to rail and conventional bus to walking and cycling is where we need to be. If we start from square one today, so if we said we don't want Metro bus, we'd lose, I don't know, 190 million, we'd lose credibility. If you want anything funded in the future, you'll probably go to the back of the queue.
What about the arena? You mentioned that just now. You think this is going to be good value for money for Bristol, for Bristol taxpayers? Why should taxpayers fund it if a private company doesn't think it's worth building?
Well, there's private investment involved in it.
Well, why not just let a private company, a private developer, build it if you think it's going to be viable?
Well, there's also land assets as well. So there's been a lot of work to put together the land, and central government has helped to actually do that. I think it would be a good thing for the city. We are losing out in terms of our economy. So, for example, conferences, major gigs are going elsewhere. I want to see a lot of those jobs coming from people within the city who need work and need skills.
So basically we need a pop concert venue. Why not use one of the stadiums?
Well, they're not large enough. They're simply not large. You know, this will be 12,000 capacity. It will mean that we can attract some of the major gigs, major conference events. It will be a good boost for the city. But let's not forget that it's in Lawrence Hill Ward here, which is one of the most deprived wards in the city. And what I've been arguing for the last couple of years now is that a lot of those jobs and opportunities ought to be, you know, for people in Lawrence Hill and other parts of the city, where those jobs and skills are much needed.
How are you going to get a developer to say where they're going? I mean, a lot of these jobs may even be advertised abroad.
You can do it through the planning process. You can do it. It happened through Cabot Circus, where there were 4,000 jobs. A lot of those came from places like in South Bristol, because there was active involvement to encourage people to come forward. And I think it requires a proactive council and our partners to really work to ensure all the communities of Bristol get a part of this. You know, it could be really great for the city.
Well, you know what I've heard from Gary Hopkins from the Lib Dems is he's saying that, looking at the figures, we could be saddled with a massive debt in the city for decades to come because of the arena not making enough money.
Mm. Well, it's the mayor's project. It's the mayor's big project. We have all, over the years, including Gary Hopkins, worked to try and get an arena in place. I think it would be a good thing for the city's economy. It's what other major cities have as
so
well.
So you don't agree with Gary about the possibility of it actually saddling us with a load of debt for the future?
I've not seen the detailed figures on it.
Well, he's saying he hasn't either, and that's why he's worried about this.
What I know is on the enterprise zone in total, there's about 18,000 new jobs that will come on stream there over the next 10, 15 years. Those are jobs that we need as a city, and that is investment that we need as a city. And also, I think it would also help to bring forward the regeneration of Temple Meads itself, which is crying out
for
investment.
Well, it certainly is, but not necessarily. You don't have to have an arena there for
it
to be
a success.
I think
it helps unlock the potential of all that land.
What about a bus station, for goodness sake? You know, so that the trains are next to where the buses go, rather than having, you know, the number 8 bus going up and that being the only bus that goes to Temple Meads.
You need an interchange there, and this is what hopefully will come out of a redevelopment at Temple Meads.
So is it definite it's going to happen, the arena, or is it still being persuaded? Has there been a final decision made?
The mayor has been doing most of the detailed work on it. I've been concentrating on jobs and opportunities. Contracts have been signed. I think it comes to planning later on this year.
Oh, so that's really the next hurdle. What about your little spat with the mayor, though? Because last week we had in the Bristol Post the news that you'd made a U-turn and that George Ferguson had got rather cross with you, said you were playing politics over his wish to sell off the port at Bristol Port.
Well, some might say that by sacking me for giving him advice in public and consistently raising issues within cabinet, that he's playing politics by getting rid of somebody who may be one of his challengers next May. I was concerned on three counts. First of all, the city is getting £10 million from the sale of the freehold. I wanted to know how it was going to be spent. Was it going to be spent the building of affordable homes, putting in place infrastructure, or was it going to be spent on some PEP project? Second question is the Henbury Loop, vital piece of rail infrastructure. Until you find a solution about how the port's future transport needs are going to be met, it seems to me that a Henbury Loop is going to be unviable and undoable. So that's a question. The third big question for me is, if there's going to be this major international container terminal port there, could be very lucrative, creating lots of jobs, will the city share in that future prosperity? What does our 12.5% share of the port actually mean in real terms? Is it watertight? Is it guaranteed? Or could we end up not having much of a say and much of an influence over that? And these, for me, are big questions. I was saying to the mayor, wait, take further advice. What is the rush?
Well, you've been supporting the project, but at the 11th hour, just as the deal's about to go through, you say, hang on, everybody.
I've been raising these issues all the way through. On the regeneration impact, on the Henbury Loop, I commissioned more work on the Henbury Loop.
So you're saying effectively the mayor wasn't listening to you either?
He wasn't listening to anybody. I think he was determined to do this deal from day one, and that's all we wanted through. And I think...
So why didn't you pipe up earlier?
Well, I did in cabinet, and
well,
back
that's no good, is it? The public don't know what's going on. Is it like a cult? The cabinet, you're not allowed to speak anything outside.
Cabinet meetings are webcast. In the cabinet meeting in March, I raised issues around regeneration. So I've been consistent. I asked for the port to write a letter about Henbury Loop. If I hadn't asked for that, there would be no letter at all on file. You know, these have been big issues all the way through. And all I said to the mayor a couple of weeks ago is wait, take advice. He said no, accused me of playing party politics and all the rest of it. You know, I think that if you've got people in your cabinet, and we didn't have executive power, we were there purely to advise, that you listen to that advice and you're respectful towards it, and that's not what happened last week.
Do you think it was a bad idea to go in the cabinet in the first place with the mayor? Because this was bound to happen sooner or later, wasn't it?
I think there's a responsibility, particularly if you're the biggest party on the council, that you play an active role in the governance of the city. But
you've said yourself, you don't have any power. All you have is the power to advise him, and he wasn't listening.
And the mayor from day one took all the executive power for himself. I think that is a wrong system. Obviously, I can't change that now. If I became mayor, I would change that. But actually, we had the opportunity to speak out in public and to vote against the mayor. That was a condition for Labour joining the cabinet. And I exercised that right last week, and I got sacked.
So are you saying that if you were to become mayor, you would change the system?
Yes,
somehow?
I would.
How would you change it?
I would share executive power with my cabinet. I would listen more.
But you could choose exactly who those people are, so you're just going to choose your mates, aren't
you? But you could under leader of council. That hasn't changed at all. And what I've also said is it would be a majority Labour cabinet. So if there were people who were not part of the Labour Party or not part of any party who had something to offer the city and shared the same values that I have, there could be a conversation there.
But the mayor or the cabinet as a whole has about £350 million, £400 million of our money to spend every year. Mm. How would that change if you were mayor?
Well, I would listen. I would empower my cabinet to work alongside me, and I would devolve more power to the neighbourhoods as well, because I think that on one level we've said that we want the neighbourhoods to do more. We haven't done enough to share resource and power at a neighbourhood level. And let's not forget, there are 70 councillors who are all going to be elected next year. They are important community champions, And I view that role as being extremely important. I would listen to their views. I would take them on board. You know, I think the big lesson with the current mayor is he just doesn't listen. He didn't listen to me. He doesn't listen to advice.
Well, how come you stayed in three years in his cabinet where he wasn't listening?
Because you have an obligation to do the best for Bristol, and that includes giving advice, clear, consistent advice, which is what I did.
How long does it take of someone not listening to you for you to realise they're not listening?
Well, on some things he listened, on others he didn't. Unfortunately for me, personally, he didn't like what I said to him a couple of weeks ago, and I got fired. But I think you've got to step up to the plate and do your best. And I have to say to you that one of the last things I managed to do when I was in the cabinet was to sign off a project which will create 72 new affordable homes in the city. It's not a vast number, but I'm quite proud of what I did and what I managed to do, often despite having a mayor who simply wasn't particularly interested.
Well, there's a lot of people in the city saying actually the mayor system is wrong. We should have a proper system where the largest party, whatever the largest party is, forms a cabinet, and we have a leader of the council who is the leader of the largest party.
Yeah.
And that power is more shared. Yeah. Would you change the system if you got in?
It would require a referendum, because the Bristol mayoral system was established through an Act of Parliament, and other cities have the opportunity to have a referendum. And I think all parties in Bristol have signed up to asking the government, you know,
Do we have to ask Westminster if we can have allowed to have a referendum?
It requires an Act of Parliament to change the Bristol mayoral system. That's how it is.
But you could have a mayor that actually decides, well, I want to run things like this, couldn't you?
It was just set up on a different basis to the rest of the country, and it would require an Act of Parliament to get rid of the office. I believe that you can reform the way that the elected mayor operates, sharing power with a cabinet, listening to cross-party views, and actually, as I say, focusing on the issues that matter, like housing, getting the bins empty, getting a better transport system, making sure that the council deals with some of the issues affecting Bristolians every day, and actually also spending more time in the city.
Well, with the amount of power that the mayor has, is there any point in electing councillors?
I think there is. I think, you know, I've been a councillor for 9 years, and I think it's a very important job. And I think that if you have a mayor who listened to councillors across party, you get better decision making, you get more information flowing, and you'd have councillors actually contributing in a more worthwhile way. At the moment, we've got the vast majority of members of council who, you know, are not clear about what their role is, and I think they have a very important role. I'd like to enhance that role.
Just one point on the port. Yeah. Can we just make this clear?
Yeah.
We've got Avonmouth on the north side, haven't we? And we've got the Portbury Dock on the south side. And I think Avonmouth was the original one. Portbury's more recent. Where is the Bristol City Council investment?
The land that has been sold off now, which is a freehold, is about 2,000 plus acres. And it's spread across. It includes the old Chittering estate. It's a vast amount of land.
So is it both sides of the Avon?
It's a vast amount of land.
Right, so we're talking about parts of both the Avonmouth and the Portbury Docks.
Yeah,
and of course Bristol was built on its port.
Absolutely.
Why does it make any difference whether a private company or the city owns it?
This is not about who owns the port operations themselves.
But who owns the land
company,
underneath,
Yeah, and most people will understand the difference between owning the land or leasing it, and that when you own the freehold, you have leverage. So I believe that, you know, if we said to the port company, we will not dispose of the freehold until we find a solution to the Henbury Loop, for the city to agree how that funding was going to be spent, so the £9 million was going to be spent, and if we had a clear agreement about the future of that 12.5% share, then I think there could have been a better deal for Bristol. My concern, and it's shared with people across party and a large number of members of the public who have contacted me since I spoke out, was that, you know, there's a fear that we're going to regret this deal in the future, that we've handed something away that gave us a lot of leverage, that gave us some potential, and now that freehold is gone. There is no getting it back.
Well, there's some that say you've got to sell off the family silver in order to keep the city solvent.
Well, if you look at what we got back, there's £10 million. £1 million will go to the local area, which I certainly will welcome. What happens to the other £9 million? Well, maybe £3 or £4 million of that is going to be spent paying off debt. That leaves you with about £5 to £6 million. That doesn't even build you a train station these days. So we've sold over 2,000 plus acres of freehold land, and we get £5 or £6 million. Now, £5 or £6 million to me is a huge amount of money.
I mean, has there been,
in the scheme of things, it's
has
a very
there been
small
political manoeuvrings behind the scenes here? Do you think?
In terms of?
Well, in terms of deals done with landowners, private individuals, private companies and the mayor.
That's not really for me to say. I just know that...
I know there was a donation, wasn't there, from the Bristol Port to Charlotte Leslie, Tory MP, for example.
Well, that's for others to talk about. Where I'm coming from is based on the information that I've seen. There were questions. I raised those questions in public. I got sacked. But I think the public's on my side, and I've had people contacting me who I simply don't know, saying, well done, you know, you spoke out. And I think to accuse me of playing party politics when I raised these issues, which I think are important issues for Bristol, I think it was the mayor who was playing the party politics and not me.
Well, enough Bristol politics for a minute, because we had a big real political demonstration last weekend. That was last Saturday. End Austerity Now, the People's Assembly Against Austerity rally up in London. And it always annoys me, because I sometimes switch on the news and think, well, let's see what was said at this interesting rally up at Trafalgar Square, Parliament Square, by some of the most radical thinkers in the country. People like Russell Brand. I want to see, but they never have them on the news. So let's have a listen now to one of the speeches, or an excerpt from Mark Steele, and he's one of the spokespeople from the People's Assembly Against Austerity.
There is a group of people who have caused the crisis, that have got all the money, that need to have their books balanced. And that is the people who've got the money in this country, the poor. It seems it's the poor who've got it all. We can't build the things that we built 100 years ago. 100 years ago we built libraries and schools and we were happy to do so. Now we've got to shut these things down. We're poorer than we were 100 years ago. And who's got all the money? The poor have taken it, obviously. That's the logic of it. Walk around London, see who's got the money. The poor in their gold sleeping bags, rolling in it. Look at them all. People in care homes that are now being shut down. Good for greedy old dudes taking all the money. Gambling all their money on stock exchanges while they go up and down the stair lift. Firemen, lollipop ladies, people who are having their jobs taken away from them. These are the people, it seems, that have got all the money. You can't complain, you're not even allowed to. We've had the argument, it's finished. If you're relying on a food bank, just whistle as you do so, because it's all finished. You can't complain. If you're being thrown out of your house because it's got a bedroom that isn't being slept in every single night of the week, and you're being thrown out by a man called Ian Duncan Smith, who lives in a mansion which he was given by a relative, which has 8 spare bedrooms, and which I would be very happy to take off him. If that is the case, don't complain about it. It's all finished. That's the end. We've had the election. But the most annoying part of this argument is that one group of people that seems to have accepted this argument is most of the people at the top of the Labour Party. They seem to believe that the reason Labour lost the election was that they weren't pro-business enough. Where there was an alternative, where there was an alternative that had credibility, where there was an alternative that looked to inspire people, an alternative to the squalid, decrepit, filthy, rotten attitude that says that a tiny handful of people at the top of society have every right to take the lot and to then squander what there is left. To say to the poor, you've got too much, we want even more, we want the Roman Abramoviches and the Mittals and the very rich people, the people like Osborne and Cameron, born into tens of millions of pounds of wealth, we think it's not enough that they've got that much, we think they should have more and you should have even less. Where there was an alternative put forward to that squalid attitude, then people did vote for it and people did take it up. The reason the paper's off was not because they were too left-wing, it's because they didn't inspire people, they didn't make people think, yes, here is an alternative that I can believe in.
Well, that's Mark Steele there speaking last Saturday. A rally estimated around about 250,000 people there. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Why didn't the Labour Party inspire people at the last election?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. It's very hard to say in one soundbite, as it were.
Because, I mean, he's hinting there at the Scottish National Party, isn't he? Yeah. He's saying they really did inspire and grabbed votes in Scotland. Why didn't the Labour Party do something similar in England?
Well, don't forget the electoral system is a major problem.
He's not saying that. He's saying it's the personalities.
It is a major problem because it means that we can't actually develop alternative narratives in a realistic way.
But why does the system stop people giving out a vision?
Because what effectively the Labour Party in a first past the post system, the Labour Party is a big coalition. And that means that you've got to keep certain people happy on one wing of the party and other people happy on the other wing of the party. If you had proportional representation, as they've had in Ireland since 1920, for example, then these different views can be expressed in a more nuanced way, and then you can then bring people together in wider coalitions.
But it's not about the system. It's because the SNP inspired people. The English Labour Party didn't.
The British Labour Party is split between people like Peter Mandelson and Yvette Cooper, for example, who think that we are not pro-business enough, and people like me who despise such an attitude. And the fact is that the party can only win by remaining united under the first-past-the-post system.
Isn't it a little bit like the Conservative Party with their pro- and anti-Europe?
Indeed.
I mean, that's broken politics.
It is, but our whole system of doing things is way past its sell-by date. Now, paradoxically enough, as we've discussed on this programme a lot, Tony, if there had been a PR election in Britain, it would have been a Tory-UKIP coalition which would have won. 50.5% of the votes. First time ever.
So it wouldn't have made much difference.
No, it would have made a difference. That's the first time ever. The Thatcher era, there was never a mandate, if you counted it up in a PR sense, for any of the things that happened, like the privatisation of the railways, privatisation of the bus industry, the crushing of the mining industry. The problem is, once you've actually done all of that, you've actually mashed the society. It's like you can put things into a blender, but you can't then put them out of the blender and sort them out again. So, but even if we'd had a much bigger proportion of UKIP in a coalition with the Tories, lots of UKIP voters aren't in fact pro-austerity. They're not.
Okay, we've got another Labour Party member in here. That's Mark Bradshaw, standing for candidate mayor of Bristol. At least it looks like he may be. Mark, why did Labour fail to inspire? I think that it's quite clear that the Scottish National Party did touch a nerve the Labour Party failed to touch here in England.
Well, I think that there was a very clear pincer movement by the Tories to frighten English voters again about an SNP domination. Well, we've got now 50 SNPs in Parliament, SNP MPs in Parliament. And I think that played very, very badly, particularly in the later stages of the campaign. I think there's another lesson, never believe opinion polls again. But as far as I'm concerned, and just looking at the Bristol picture, it is the poorest and the most vulnerable who are picking up the tab for mistakes made by bankers. And I think somebody said the other day that if building hospitals and refurbishing schools and doing all the other things that Labour did during its term of office, if that contributed to the economic downturn, the investment in those public services has revolutionised, a lot of experiences.
Was false accounting a mistake? Was LIBOR a mistake? Was PPI a mistake?
Well, and those responsible in the banking industry, have been fined. There's been some huge fines against banks.
But these are piffling fines compared to the profits that banks have made out of us.
Well, I'm not responsible for the courts, I have to say. But if you look at Bristol at the moment, we've got about 20,000 children who are in poverty. We've got about 22,000 homes that are in fuel poverty. We've got 15 food banks, and we're one of the most prosperous cities in the UK outside London. So I think the priorities within Bristol are in the wrong place. I think we've got to focus on these particular concerns and start to put people first.
Well,
and
we're going to go to Prime Minister's questions, a couple of questions from there in a minute. But before Prime Minister's questions, just as it was about to start, there was a protest in the House of Commons lobby, in the Houses of Parliament lobby, just outside the House of Commons, where a whole group of scores of disabled people rushed at the doors and very nearly got into the House of Commons chamber to disrupt Prime Minister's questions. And here's the BBC's Norman Smith.
You can probably hear it behind me, a number of disability protesters who are protesting about the Independent Living Fund. About 10 minutes ago, they rushed towards the members' lobby there where the Commons chamber is, in an effort, it seems, to get into the chamber in the middle of Prime Minister's questions. Now, the police, about 30 or 40 police, closed the door, stopped them from getting in, and they weren't able to get into central lobby, and Prime Minister's questions carried on, seemingly, I think, oblivious to what has been going on here. But I have to say, I've never seen scenes like this before, with protesters chanting, shouting, just yards from the Commons chamber. They started off perfectly peacefully. I was talking to some of them before Prime Minister's questions got underway. They were giving out leaflets. They were hoping to see some MPs. And then, as I say, whether it was prepared in advance, I don't know. But suddenly there was a concerted rush towards the members' lobby as they tried to catch the police off guard. And initially, it seemed almost as if they'd got through before the doorman managed to close the huge doors to the central lobby before they could actually get through. But you can see the demonstration is still going on here as police try to lift them out and clear them away. And this is what they're protesting about, the Independent Living Fund. And all this, of course, before we know of further possible cuts to some disability benefits. Excuse me, do you mind coming here, sir? You're part of this demonstration.
Yes.
What are you actually protesting about?
Well, basically, they're closing down the ILF, which is the Independent Living Fund. Independent living is vital to the lives of disabled people. Why should it be fragmented down to councils who can't afford it? We've been told now that some people, rather than getting funding, that they're going to be given incontinence pads and be told to get on with it. Where's the aspiration for our lives, to our choices, to run our lives the way we're supposed to live? Where is the dignity?
Well, taking away money and giving them incontinence pads in return. Martin, this is actually quite sinister, isn't it? Where disabled people feel it necessary to take such extreme measures to get their point heard. It doesn't sound like they're being listened to by the rich and powerful. This is actually quite chilling.
Well, it is. I mean, of course, the Tories said they're going to carry out £12 billion worth of welfare cuts, and they're going to announce them in the budget the next week or the week after, but they didn't say where or how they were going to make these cuts. And you'd have thought, well, hang on a minute. When they're running the government, they say, oh, yes, we've managed to save money and we've managed to save billions, but we're going to make 12 billion more savings, but we can't tell you where.
So there's millions of people in fear, actually not and knowing indeed, if they're going to be able to carry on or not.
Indeed, and the fundamental point, as made by Mark earlier, why should the poorest and most vulnerable people of our society pay the price for the mistakes made in the City of London from the 1980s onwards? And they shouldn't. I mean, when the crash happened in 2008, I said on this show, I'm not prepared to see a single penny taken off the bottom half of the population to cover this. If the wealthy have messed it up, the wealthy should pay
the
bill.
Ian Duncan Smith would say, we cannot afford this massive benefits bill anymore.
Well, and we can't afford to bail out RBS, can we? This is why we're selling it at a massive loss to their friends in the city. There's been the propaganda.
Wasn't that about £10 billion we lost on RBS?
Exactly. So, in other words, we're going to lose nearly £12 million on selling RBS at less than it's worth in order to get rid of it. At the same time, they're going to cut £12 billion from the welfare bill. Go figure. They should actually hang on to RPS and save the money by putting it back into running as a public sector institution.
And of course, you see the botched privatisation of the Royal Mail as well, which also costs the taxpayer fortune. This axing of the Independent Living Fund, I think it affects around 18,000 quite disabled people. It's just a shameful cut because it will save what? £300 million, which in the scheme of things is not a vast amount, but it will have a huge impact on their lives. and just bouncing the responsibility to local councils with budgets under pressure, adult social services under huge pressure, is just really not going to help things at all. It's going to be hugely damaging.
Well, at Prime Minister's questions, we're going to stay with the subject of benefits.
Marie Rimmer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister has repeatedly been reported as saying he wants to create, quote, a new era of transparency in government. Given his desire, why is the Secretary of State, DWP, refusing to release the statistics relating to the death of people who have been declared fit for work, as instructed to do so by the Information Commissioner? Yeah. Intervene and get the DWP Secretary to comply with the spirit of your desire and the request, the instruction of the Information Commissioner.
Minister, first of all, let me reassure the Honourable Lady, this data will be published and is being prepared for publication as we speak. I think it is important that we publish data, and this government has published more data about public spending than any previous government.
Actually, that data is not about public spending. It's actually about how many people have died, even though they've been classed as fit for work, Martin.
Well, indeed. I mean, the viciousness of the assault on the poorest and most vulnerable in our community is unconscionable. And I think that when we've got certain people in the Labour leadership saying, for example, that we're going along with the narrative on this, I'm not very happy with that. The Labour Party, I mean, at one stage, I think it was Yvette Cooper was saying, we can't be seen as the party of the unemployed. I think, hang on a minute, no. I mean, the first Labour government in the 1920s split on exactly this kind of issue. People, when I'm knocking on doors for the Labour Party, especially in deprived communities, I want those people to know, not just to feel, but to know that we're on their side. And if some people don't like that further up the social hierarchy, well, I'm afraid that's just too bad.
And I think that you need a thriving economy. So I was talking to a small business last week that employs about 60 people in Bristol. So you've got to get a balance between understanding what you need for a strong, thriving economy and making sure that those job opportunities go to people in the greatest need. But what you're seeing with this government and the £12 billion, and it may be more, of cuts that are coming forward, is it's the poorest who are paying the price. And whether it's food poverty, energy poverty, children poverty, even in a city like Bristol, which outwardly the perception is it's a prosperous place, these are real divisions in our city, and we need a greater focus on them.
One of the things that really brings people together in the city is the St Paul's Carnival. Absolutely. And we've heard that the St Paul's Carnival is cancelled this year. I'm not sure who, I think the chair is John Farquharson, although he hasn't put his name to the various statements that have come out about the carnival being cancelled. What's your understanding of this? Because this is a major blow, isn't it, really? Yeah. Why on earth, we've got some sort of ticket-only event where you've got to buy the tickets beforehand to replace it, other than an event which brings something like 100,000 people to Bristol for a great day out, although, of course, there are always a few incidents that the police have to be called to.
Well, I've just read about this in the press today, like you have, and it's hugely disappointing. St Paul's Carnival is a really important event for the city. It brings people together. It brings in the visitors. It is good for Bristol's economy. And it's really one of the most inclusive events that we have. If you look at the makeup, for example, of Make Sunday Special, it's not particularly inclusive. St Paul's Carnival is. It's a real pity that it's not going to happen. I don't know what this alternative event is. I think there's a need for people to come together and find a more sustainable long-term way of funding the St Paul's Carnival. I wouldn't want to lose it in the future, but I think there's some serious work required to find a way of funding it over the long term.
I think the last couple of years it's been on, Martin. Was maybe the previous, was it maybe 2013 or something, that they had to cancel it for 1 year. Mm. But this is a blow, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, I very much enjoy the carnival every year, and I shall miss it. But it's very easy. I mean, I don't have the information. If the money's not there, the money's not there.
I don't think it's just about money. It's to do with policing and organisation. Well, you just don't have the confidence
Yes, I mean, if it was to do with policing, like the Green Gathering a few years ago was actually cancelled because the police insisted that they had to have private security and so on, well, we'd know what the issue was. But I don't know what the issue is here.
No, they haven't really been very clear in the statement that they've made about exactly what's caused it. So I'd like, we'll have to see if we can get hold of this chappy John Farquharson, whoever John Farquharson is. John, tell us, why is it cancelled? Give us a good explanation, please, rather than just, sorry, it ain't happening. Also, secret talks. This is, I think, at the end of last week in the Bristol Post, to expand Bristol, Mark Bradshaw. What's going on here? Bristol could expand its city's boundaries. But why are the talks secret?
I'm not aware of any talks, so unless I've been left out of them over the last couple of months.
The Bristol Post understands discussions are going on within government over whether the city has outgrown its existing boundaries. I mean, yeah, you know, this is Kingswood, I imagine, a bit of South Gloucestershire, that kind of thing.
I'm just not sure if that's credible, because I think the real issue for the city is how we work together with our neighbouring authorities.
But they're saying basically the local enterprise partnership is looking like a good kind of body to move the sort of political boundaries together, because the local enterprise partnership covers the wider the wider conurbation.
But it's also largely unaccountable, and I would be very, very uneasy with that.
They spend a lot of public money.
Well, they do, and they're not particularly accountable. And apart from the four leaders of the local authorities, that's about as far as it goes in terms of democratic oversight.
They seem to give grants to themselves. I mean, the Western College, for example, has just given itself a big grant through the local enterprise partnership, and they're one of the main people who sit on the local enterprise partnership to refurbish the winter gardens at Weston-super-Mare, which they bought for £1. Doesn't really sound like it's got proper democratic oversight.
I don't think that the real issue for Bristol is grabbing land from neighbouring authorities. It's about working together much more closely, ending up work that I was doing, for example, to try and reach a point where we had a combined transport authority with South Gloss, so we could have power over buses and over trains. It's about working together on housing issues and how we're going to build more homes. I don't think that requires a glorified land grab across boundary. What it requires is greater trust and confidence between the four councils, and at times that's put under strain with talk around land grabs and metro mayors and all the rest of it, which I think are quite fanciful.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, it's been interesting to get your take on what's been going on in Greece with the Germans taking them to the line. Also this week, a fascinating story in the Daily Mirror, city analysts, VP Research, have issued doom-laden warnings about the future of the country's economy if Chancellor George Osborne pushes ahead with his plans. George Osborne's brutal spending cuts could plunge Britain into recession, warn these city experts.
There's every possibility. We've got 5 years, but by the rules, the silly rules they've passed themselves, that they've got over a 5-year parliamentary term. I think long before 5 years are up.
They're saying it looks now, the economy's looking now resembling how it looked prior to the financial crisis in 2008.
Absolutely. We've got a property bubble in Britain of a traditional kind. Meanwhile, the City of London is up to its eyes in derivatives bets on things like the Greek crisis. People don't talk about this, but the banks are still insolvent. RBS is still actually worth less than it was when it was bought by the taxpayer.
Well, they're also saying
nothing has changed.
Countries that haven't faced spending cuts have tended to perform better than Britain.
Well, indeed, because in actual fact, we were talking, when you mentioned earlier about getting the economy right and also getting fairness right, it's actually bad economics to cut welfare spending for the weakest people in the society. Think about what happens in weak, small areas where a lot of people are on low wages or on benefits. Cuts in benefits actually weaken the local economy. And of course, they're cutting back public expenditure, but we're still printing the money press is still running full belt to keep the financial system afloat.
I was walking around Quaker's Friars yesterday in the city centre, the wonderful part of the new Cabot Circus. Half of the shops are empty, folks. They're closing down. There's even one of them has got a great big 50% off sale of posh bags. A lot of those shops are now empty. And also, we were chatting last week about the cab drivers talking to me, saying a lot of the cab drivers simply aren't renewing their licences because they're not. There's not enough work for them.
I think the Tories have put across a very clever story that everything's fine, everything's better now.
Yeah.
Move on, there is nothing to see. But for many, many people, they are struggling. They're struggling with rents that they can barely afford.
Because some people aren't struggling. Industrial feudalism, we're talking about that in the second half. Fat cats are getting even fatter. Bosses' earnings are surging to 149% more than their staff. This is in the Mirror. The widening pay gap between top chief executives and workers has reached astonishing levels, according to a study.
I don't think I have any fat cats in my constituency, but I do hear from people who are finding it really, really tough. They can't afford the rents. They've got very insecure leases. They've got often very, very insecure as it's 0 hours jobs.
But it's not 10 times more they're earning than the staff, 150 times more.
I know. But the Tory narrative is very much about, you know, things have improved. There is not a problem. Let's move on. And what I'm saying is, for many, many people who often lack a voice, times are getting tougher and tougher. And this 12 billion plus cuts that are coming forward in the next budget are going to show that up.
One of the backdrops to all of this, of course, is the strike by the French ferry people this week, and the incredible scenes of migrants trying to basically threatening drivers, etc., and trying to get on. We've also had the figures this week about the British population going up by 500,000. Mark, can we stand all this migration?
I think Britain's always been a welcoming country for those who are fleeing violence and war.
Hungary's got about 30,000 extra people coming into Hungary, right? That's what the Hungarian, I was listening to some of the Hungarians saying, we've got 30,000, and they're protesting because they've got 30,000. Yeah. We've got 500,000 more.
Yeah. But it's important that this is tackled at both an EU level and also a global level as well. There are mass migration.
Mark, no one's doing it.
This is what is required. You know, this is the madness of those who say that we should just pull out of EU and pull out of other things. You know, this has to be tackled at a global level. There are mass migrations of people who are fleeing from violence and persecution, but also shortages of things like water and food as well. And
but
it's
this is being
get worse.
Dealt with at a Brussels level, and it's not happening. So why do you say we need to deal with it at a Brussels level?
Well, there was a summit meeting this week, which David Cameron took part in. I think that the Italians in particular were very disappointed at the lack of progress. It is the poorest countries, particularly in southern Europe, that are facing the brunt of this, and I think we've got to come together as a European Union and globally and try and support those under greatest pressure. But this is not going to go away. This is a long-term trend as there's more instability in the world.
Well, I mean, I think the Queen would agree with you. We're talking about the European Union and making sure we keep the EU together, because she was over in Berlin this week and she having a rather nice banquet, actually, with the German president in Berlin. So let's have a listen to what the Queen had to say. I put this on the politics show because she's clearly not an impartial Queen. She's definitely got things to say about the EU.
In our lives, Mr. President, we have seen the worst, but also the best of our continent. We have witnessed how quickly things can change for the better. But we know that we must work hard to maintain the benefits of the post-war world. We know that division in Europe is dangerous and that we must guard against it in the West as well as in the east of our continent. That remains a common endeavor.
Ein einiges Europa, eine starke Union stehen für Stabilität, für Frieden und Freiheit für uns alle.
And I think the Queen probably understood that perfectly well. I wonder if she was visiting some of her old schlosses, Martin.
Well, I mean, when you say that's political, that will have been written by the Foreign Office representing the view of the British government, just as a Queen's speech in Parliament is the view of the government. So it's no use attacking the Queen for saying these things. She didn't write it off her own bat. She's just reading lines that have been given to her by the Cameron government.
OK, Martin, that's all we've got time for. Thanks very much to our guest. That's Mark Bradshaw, who may be standing. He's a Labour for Bedminster, Labour councillor, may be standing for Mayor. After the news, it's industrial feudalism.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.